Thank you all very much. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Katie Zoglin, a trustee of the council and your moderator for this evening's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest, Ambassador Richard Schmier, currently serves as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Diplomacy in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. His long and distinguished career in the State Department includes serving as Ambassador to Oman and as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iraq. From 2005 to 2007, he taught at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Ambassador Schmier holds a master's and a PhD from University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ambassador Richard Schmier.
Katie, Jordan, thank you very much for that very kind invitation, and thank all of you for being here this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here, and it's a great opportunity for me to hear from you and to have a dialogue with you on really some very, very important developments in the region of the world in which I'm currently involved, the Middle East. I am very happy to be able to get out to engage such well-informed and such influential audiences, and I really look forward to bringing back to Washington your thoughts, your ideas, your perspectives on some of these important issues. Let me begin simply by noting, reiterating what I'm sure all of you are very aware of, and that was, and that is that last week was a very difficult and a very sad week for those of us engaged in diplomacy, and in particular, those of us who work in diplomacy in the Middle East. Having myself just returned last month from a three-year assignment as the U.S. ambassador in Oman, I was particularly concerned, and obviously the affinity that I feel to my colleagues in that region is very strong. I and of course all of my colleagues at the State Department and those elsewhere in government, and we have a broad group of people who are involved in our diplomatic efforts, those who are doing America's diplomatic work, were extremely gratified and very pleased at the outpouring of support that was shown by the American people and the American leadership for those who we lost in Benghazi last week. I had the honor of attending the ceremony at Andrews Air Force Base last Friday, where the remains of the four lost were returned, and hearing President Obama and Secretary Clinton comment on the loss and on our efforts going forward to ensure that the work they were doing continues to be done, given its importance for our country. The President was very articulate in delivering his comments and in praising the four individuals who were lost last week, Glenn Daugherty, Tyrone Woods, Sean Smith, and Ambassador Chris Stevens. In responding to those events, the President, in his weekly radio address last Saturday, reaffirmed America's commitment to our engagement in the region, and especially in countries such as Libya, which are undergoing transition. As he said when speaking of those lost in Benghazi, we must reaffirm that we will carry on the work of our fallen heroes. That commitment to support the efforts and aspirations of the people of the region who are seeking positive change for their countries and societies is precisely what those whom we lost would have wanted us to do. However, as the President also said, it is important that we seek justice for those whom we've lost. In his words, we must send a clear and resolute message to the world. Those who attack our people will find no escape from justice. We will not waver in their pursuit, and we will never allow anyone to shake the resolve of the United States of America. And equally importantly, he added There is never any justification for violence. There is no religion that condones the targeting of innocent men and women. There is no excuse for attacks on our embassies and consulates, and so long as I am Commander-in-Chief, the United States will never tolerate efforts to harm our fellow Americans. The apparent trigger for much of the violence of last week, a film denigrating the Prophet Muhammad and Islam, also brought into focus the challenges we face in today's world of instant worldwide communication and the ability of these new technologies to be misused by extremists and bigots to provoke outrage, even violence. Secretary Clinton addressed this issue at an event commemorating the recent Muslim Eid al-Fitr holiday at the State Department last Thursday, making it clear that the United States has a profound respect for people of all faiths, that we stand for religious freedom, and that we reject the denigration of any religion, including Islam. In the days since the attack, many people in the region, including many Libyans, have expressed their sorrow and solidarity. One young woman in Benghazi held up a handwritten sign that said, "Thugs and killers don't represent Benghazi nor Islam." This woman's sentiments reflect another point made by Secretary Clinton in remarks last week. As she said, and I quote, "The people of Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Tunisia did not trade the tyranny of a dictator for the tyranny of a mob," end quote. However, it is important to remember that these countries have experienced long periods of trauma and that the people are just learning how to responsibly use their newfound freedoms. But equally importantly, we and others who support their democratic aspirations and transitions must help ensure that the people and their governments also embrace the responsibilities which accompany that freedom. Importantly, President Obama and Secretary Clinton have also stressed that we will do all that is necessary to protect our people and our facilities abroad. But at the same time, it is important that we not lose sight of the fundamental fact that America must keep leading the world. We owe it to those lost in Benghazi last week to continue the long, hard work of diplomacy. The United States is the greatest force for peace, progress, and human dignity the world has ever known. In the Secretary's words, "If the last few days teach us anything, let it be this, that this work and the men and women who risk their lives to do it are at the heart of what makes America great and good." Having witnessed the profound changes in the Middle East since the advent of the Arab Awakening almost 2 years ago, our leaders and we who conduct America's diplomacy must chart a path forward that secures the historic opportunity we face while safeguarding long-standing U.S. interests. It remains a dramatic time for us to stand at the forefront of U.S. foreign policy as moments of change are translated into real, workable governance systems. People across the region have let it be known that they seek the basic dignity that comes from political and economic opportunity and will no longer tolerate corrupt governments that deny the legitimate aspirations of the people. As a new era of leadership emerges in the region, the substance as well as the style of our diplomacy has to change. We are engaging a wide range of new actors, including many whom we would not have been able to work with, and we too are more mindful of the force of public opinion. However, we have no illusions about the challenges that the region is facing and the challenges and risks that we will face as we move forward. We are now entering a new period as we address the next phase of the region's transitions. The region has changed. Public opinion matters more than ever before in these countries, and leaders around the region now understand that they must be responsive to the needs and aspirations of their people. The United States is changing how it operates in the region. President Obama and Secretary Clinton have been clear. Supporting democratic transitions is a top priority for the United States. The success of the transitions will serve the long-term interests of the people in the region in building a better future and will also serve American long-term interests in a better relationship with a more stable region. But some things have not changed. Our core interests remain. We seek protection of basic values and human rights, continued efforts against terrorist organizations, energy security, Arab-Israeli peace, and peace and stability throughout the region. Long-term threats to that stability remain, including demographics, with well over half of the region's population being members of a large youth cohort, which is changing these societies and presenting new challenges, as well as new opportunities, to their governments. Economies struggling to provide jobs to this massive cohort as it matures. A continuing regional threat from Iran, and a continued lack of a just solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. We are changing the way we secure our core interests and address long-term threats to stability. We see the promotion of political reform as necessary to achieve the stability we seek. As Secretary Clinton has said, we recognize that the real choice is between reform and unrest, with reform being the only realistic path towards regional stability. As you know, in the Middle East, we are operating in a context of significant regional instability. The Assad regime's brutal repression of its people has created tremendous suffering and regional turmoil. Yemen faces a security threat from al-Qaeda, but the new government of President Hadi is working to promote a political transition, economic growth, and greater security and stability. Our support for countries in transition, including Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and Yemen, is necessary to secure American interests and ensure the long-term stability of the region. Iran's government is the outlier in all of these developments. It finds itself increasingly isolated as its policies contribute to instability in the region. Its repression of its own citizens, its support for the Assad regime in Syria and that regime's violence against its own people, its sponsorship of terrorist and extremist groups elsewhere, and, of course, its nuclear program, are all alienating it from others in the region and from the spirit of the Arab awakening. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations preaching violence as the path for political change have been delegitimized and marginalized. The largely nonviolent revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt did more to bring about positive political change for the people of the Middle East in a matter of weeks than terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda relying on violence had accomplished in years. We are pressing political reforms, and we are deploying our diplomatic and economic resources to support those who have taken the necessary and courageous steps towards democracy and more inclusive political systems. Economic opportunity will be a vital component of the success of the transitions. The United States has made significant financial commitments to countries in transition. Already, we have spent over $1 billion in support of the region's democratic transitions, and we will continue to seek ways to support the region's forward movement. There are, of course, challenges ahead. So let me close my prepared remarks by noting some of those specific challenges. First, obviously, the original topic of tonight's discussion, Syria. How will that crisis unfold? Syria is the most immediate and urgent concern. For more than a year now, the United States and our partners have worked to find a peaceful solution to the crisis in Syria, but the Assad regime continues its unconscionable assaults against the Syrian people. For now, Russia and China continue to protect Assad and defy the overwhelming majority of the Security Council and the broader international community, who, by contrast, have stood with the Syrian people in their time of need. The U.S. message has been consistent and clear. We are taking a three-pillar approach on Syria. Those pillars are, number one, supporting the opposition and its efforts to end the violence and to continue to build towards a free and democratic Syria. Two, responding to the massive humanitarian crisis in the region that the Assad regime is actively perpetuating. And three, aggressively ramping up planning and preparations for a post-Assad Syria. We are greatly concerned by the impact of the violence on Syria's neighbors, notably Jordan and Lebanon. We continue to believe that a political transition in Syria, led by the Syrian people and supported by the international community, is the best path for Syria's future. Second, how will Egypt navigate its transition? President Morsi has formed a government and has retired much of the former military leadership. However, Egypt still faces key political challenges as it drafts a constitution and resolves the status of parliament, as well as key security challenges, including the situation in the Sinai. Egypt's economy remains a concern as well, and a potential Achilles heel to the success of the country's political transition. And we continue to look for ways in which the United States, our partners, and the international financial institutions can help. We are especially encouraging Egypt's regional friends, including those in the Gulf, to do the same and to follow through on prior assistance pledges. We believe that a prosperous and democratic Egypt, buoyed by a strong private sector with open and mutually beneficial economic ties to its neighbors, can be an engine of growth and a source of stability for the Middle East and North Africa. Finally, how will governments in non-transitioning countries respond to popular pressure for reform? A number of governments, having heard their people's demand for change, have taken steps to initiate reforms. We will be watching these reform efforts closely and will be working with governments to support their commitments to reform. In doing so, we will continue, as we always have, promoting American principles as we pursue American interests. As we witness the historic changes taking place in the Middle East, it is important to remember that we are only in the early stages of a regional transformation. Every country in the Middle East suffers from the structural pressures that created the conditions for these revolutions. We will continue to press for political reform across the region, guided by our universal principles, but implementing them in ways tailored to the specific situation of each country in our region. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to a robust and fruitful discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those very interesting remarks. Right now, we're going to start with the question period. We have a couple of members of the audience who were interested in what's going on in Syria, and to follow on your comments about the United States standing up for its values and people wanting to know whether or not this is a situation in which the United States should intervene militarily, and what factors would the United States take into account in doing so, not doing so? Yeah.
Well, let me just mention and certainly stress and reiterate, we are all agreed the situation in Syria is a true human tragedy, and the people of Syria are suffering tremendously, essentially at the hands of their own government. Many people of goodwill from many different points of view have made a number of different suggestions as to how those of us who support the Syrian people might do that, might support them. It is a complicated scenario. It's a complicated issue. Our position at this point is that we are providing non-lethal support to the opposition so that they can better communicate, coordinate, plan, and be more effective. Other countries have taken other decisions, and obviously those who support the Syrian people, they will take what steps they feel they should take. But the complication, the challenges, whether it's military, whether it's the nature of the opposition, those kinds of factors all come into play in determining how one can best support the people in their current struggle against their own government. Even among those in the opposition, there are different points of view on the issue of international involvement. So we continue to stay engaged, to monitor, to provide non-lethal support, and we certainly are trying to work with all of those who wish well for Syria to bring the crisis to an end as soon as possible.
What is it that divides the opposition, and how can the international community effectively engage with a fragmented opposition?
Well, I think if you look back, of course, the demonstrations, the kind of the speaking out of the people now goes back well over a year. It was sparked at the time of the Arab Awakening by the kinds of events that were taking place in the region. And it was quite clear, certainly from my vantage point, I was in a nearby country in Oman, it seemed the effort of the Syrian people as they started demonstrating, which of course they did so nonviolently, was to try to bring to their country the kinds of principles that the demonstrators and those who removed their governments in other countries in the region were seeking for their country. So I think the idea of the opposition from the beginning was to try to move Syria into a new era in which the kinds of principles, human rights, protection of minorities, rule of law, those kinds of principles that we espouse and that the people in the countries who were working to remove their governments were espousing were also the goals of the Syrian opposition. Now, the opposition today really has become, it incorporates many elements, and I think it's important to try to encourage all of those elements to become more unified, to become more sort of focused in working together on their efforts. Potentially, some of those elements might not share some of the fundamental values that actually started the uprising. And so I think that's something that within the opposition they need to be sensitive to and to address. So the complexity of the situation is such that we currently have ended up where we are in terms of our believing that our role at this point is the best role we can play at this point is the one that I laid out in my remarks and in my previous comment.
And We also have questions about what concerns the State Department may have regarding spillover effects of what's going on in Syria. For example, in Jordan, you know, just the other day we heard of shells going into Lebanon and so on.
Yeah. Well, certainly there have been instances of sort of violence spilling over the borders, which obviously is a tragedy for the neighboring countries. On a more ongoing basis, there's the real challenge and the real destabilizing effect of the refugee flows into those countries. And so certainly Jordan and Lebanon, even Iraq and Turkey, are seeing refugee flows, which potentially are destabilizing to those countries as well. So the violence and the crisis in Syria itself, while tragic for Syria, clearly is also having negative effects on neighboring countries in a region that really has a lot of challenges in its own right. So I think all of us recognize the importance of trying to bring stability back, trying to end the crisis in Syria, to try to reestablish what level we can of stability and economic well-being among the people there, because the refugees are really straining the capabilities of the neighboring governments to deal with the humanitarian issues that those refugees have brought with them.
And moving to your old stomping grounds, the Gulf region, what do you think the reaction of the leaders or the people of the Emirates and perhaps even the broader Gulf region if Israel bombs Israel's nuclear centers?
Well, of course, that's a very delicate issue in its own right, and obviously Israel is considering what's in its interests, and I think our president has spoken very, very articulately and extensively on that issue. But in terms of a reaction, that's, I think, frankly, hard to predict. Certainly no one wants to see that step happen. We are working, and we still are of the opinion that through dialogue, through diplomacy, frankly, as well as through pressure, and that's the sanctions side of the engagement, that we can bring that issue to a resolution which meets our goal, which is that Iran not become a nuclear state, and that's a goal shared, I'm sure, by all of the countries in the region. What reaction might be to such a hypothetical undertaking would be hard to guess, and I think it would probably depend on the circumstances at the time, the reactions in other places. Our effort really is to make sure that kind of situation does not come about because of the efforts we're making both through diplomacy and through pressure on Iran to change its course.
And on a more personal level, we have some members of the audience who wanted to know what was it like to be an ambassador in the Middle East during the Arab Spring, in the uprising.
Well, as I was telling some of the students a little bit before this event, it was quite an exciting time for me. I have been going to the Middle East since 1977, and I've been serving there, you know, for many years. And frankly, the last couple of years have been the most dynamic, the most interesting, and I would say the most hopeful in terms of the potential for positive change that I've seen in that long career. And so we in Oman, where I was serving, we did have a certain amount of stirring of public opinion. We did have people demonstrating peacefully for some changes. In the case of Oman, the leader of that country, Sultan Qaboos, did introduce a number of changes in response to the people's requests, which was very well received by the people. So I think it was gratifying for me, specifically where I was, to see that this broader movement, this broader awakening and kind of request for rights and for opportunities and for responsive governance was actually having an effect with the leader in the country I was serving in, making exactly those kinds of responses. I think it also underscored the importance to all of us that as I mentioned in my remarks, as we pursue, as the United States pursues its interests, which are many in the region, we have never lost sight of the fact that we have always promoted our principles. And so seeing people, particularly young people, sort of embrace those principles, because basically the kinds of principles that we stand for are the kinds of principles that they were requiring or requesting of their governments to institute, was very gratifying, and it gave us an opportunity to work with those who were speaking out on behalf of these principles to try to help them in their efforts to bring these principles to their country. And so we have a number of programs, we have a number of engagements in support of that initiative, and to me that was a very gratifying part of my experience.
Does the United States have more to lose than it has to gain from the maturing of the Arab uprising?
Well, I would say we have much, much, much more to gain, having been in the region for many, many years. I think the Secretary said it concisely when she said the choice is really one where they have to move forward. Trying to maintain the status quo is not a formula for stability. And is not in our or anyone else's interest. Now, I think the question might be predicated upon the understanding that any period of transition is a period of uncertainty and a period of risk. And so it's important that that we continue to support those who are working towards bringing these societies along to places where they have better economic opportunities for the people, better human rights and other principles underlying their societies, and not assume that the goodwill of those who are seeking this kind of change will automatically triumph. And so I do believe it's absolutely in our best interest. You look at it sort of like the fall of the Berlin Wall. I think everyone would agree that despite the turmoil and despite a period of uncertainty, the world is a better place for the fact that the countries that used to be behind the Iron Curtain now have free societies that serve the interests of their people. I think that's the kind of future that we can see now coming about in the Middle East, but it's one that's going to require support from the friends of those who support the principles the people want to institute, and that includes us.
You spoke in your remarks about the efforts as an ambassador to convey American values in the countries in which you have served. Do you see any role in which the United States should try to be a little bit more reciprocal in explaining the values of other countries here in the United States, more international values? And if so, how would that be?
Well, first of all, I guess as a general sort of point of reference in terms of that kind of dialogue between nations, one thing that we strongly encourage and directly support in many cases is international exchange. And I think there's nothing better for our country and for the countries that we want to engage with, work with, become friends with, to have people from our country go there and people from their country to come here. It is a life-changing experience, and everywhere I've gone in my diplomatic service, I've seen that those who have had the opportunity to spend time in the United States as a student or otherwise have had a much, much better understanding and appreciation of our country. It wasn't automatically a love feast, but they understood where we were coming from, as opposed to what you might perceive on a more superficial level if you rely on just the media or culture, you know, sort of modern culture. So in that sense, yes, I think an exchange of views is very important in both directions for our country and for others. Now, of course, I would leave the direct work of bringing other countries' values here to my counterparts who are the diplomats of the other countries who are here, are actually engaged in, and I hope for example, you would have Arab diplomats and other diplomats, I assume, would be coming out and meeting with your organization and doing these kinds of things. So I encourage that. I think it's great that they're also engaged in doing that. And so I think the more of that kind of intellectual and sort of exchange of ideas takes place, the better it is for our country, the better it is for the other country, and the better it is for the world.
Turning now to Libya, were there reports of security issues in Libya that perhaps there need to be tighter security related to the embassy and consular buildings in Benghazi? I didn't know if you could comment on that or what efforts were made to make sure it was a secure location.
I mean, I guess I can't say or don't know specifically because obviously there is an FBI investigation underway. Whenever Americans are harmed anywhere in the world, the FBI will investigate and will seek to bring those responsible to justice. And so obviously that's one reason why it's really not appropriate to speculate or to second guess. I do know, having served in embassies and consulates abroad for more than 20 years, that the State Department and all elements of our government are committed to the security of our people and our facilities. And we have very robust programs in place and very active what we call security offices that handle all aspects of our security. And so I'm sure that will all be reviewed. I don't know what specific circumstances were at play in Libya, but I know the commitment has been there, the resources have been there, and if lessons can be learned and there are things that we need to do differently, I'm sure that would come out of the effort to determine what happened as we seek to hold those responsible accountable for what happened.
And also, we don't hear as much in the news about Libya's transition per se, and I didn't know if you could comment on what the most recent developments have been and how it seems to be going.
Well, part of the challenge, and this is one of the, observations that arose from last week, is that the new government, the government is doing its best to try to sort of gain full control of the whole country. I think, as you're aware, as we all learned much more during the course of the revolution, Libya is a country which has very strong tribal divisions. It has different kind of geographic divisions, the Tripoli and the Benghazi sides. And a lot of the elements, a lot of the effort during the revolution was undertaken by organizations that were essentially local or not certainly not national, but more in their own area. And the Libyan government has faced the challenge now of unifying the security situation there in the face of what remain a number of local sources of power. And so we understand that is a challenge, and we understand the Libyan government is seeking to exercise full control and full sovereignty over the whole country. Certainly what we heard from the Libyan government in the aftermath of the tragedy last week indicates that they are fully committed to their responsibilities for the protection of our people and facilities. They're committed to working with us to bring those responsible to justice, and they're making every effort they can to provide the security that we and others need to conduct their business there. So the government is doing and making its best effort in a difficult time with limited resources.
And we all hear about, you know, the region is going through great deals of change. There's some describe it as chaos. Others say it's in unstable. How long, and some say that democracy will cure, you know, these bumps in the road. How long do you think that will take before it becomes more stable?
Well, I mean, I think it will be an ongoing process. I mean, one often talks about, I recall I was serving in Germany at the time when the Berlin Wall fell, and one talked about it taking a generation. I mean, that's sort of a common refrain that one hears when something as fundamental as this happens. Now, I mean, one can probably say, okay, for it to be fully effected, for the society to kind of retool its thinking and its understanding of events, et cetera, that may take many years. But it is an ongoing process. And so already, I think you're already seeing many people, and particularly young people, those who really are sort of attuned to kind of worldwide, to kind of a worldwide awareness, let's say, already I think they've begun to very successfully incorporate this new expanded worldview, which does incorporate the fundamental principles that we promote and aspire to, and that most people, I think everybody given the opportunity in the world will aspire to. So I think those principles will continue to take firmer and firmer hold in these countries, even as they have to work through specific kind of institutional development. There's a certain amount of institutional development, a certain amount of governmental development. We're working very hard, however, with a number of international and American non-governmental organizations to try to assist in that effort. And so I think that's one thing that we and others of goodwill towards these countries can do, can help them develop the institutional framework to sort of cement the kinds of processes and principles that they want to incorporate and that we want to help them incorporate into their countries.
And there's a number of questions from members of the audience, I think, expressing frustration on what's going on in Syria, as I know you have also expressed, but also wanting to know a little bit, if you could provide a little more detail on what the United States is doing on the humanitarian level, and also given the roadblocks that Russia and others are posing in Security Council, is the United States considering perhaps going through NATO or some other block to try to get some progress for the Syrian people?
Well, and certainly anybody who's frustrated with Syria has every right to be. It is a tragedy. It's a crisis. And obviously, the situation there is very, very difficult. As we look, and we and others who are trying to help the Syrian people look for ways to assist, there are a number of avenues. Now, some, as you mentioned, with Russia and China's position on the Security Council, we have not been successful in working with the large majority of those who wish to have a Security Council resolution on Syria in getting that passed. We, however, are continuing the effort to do so. We think that would provide a significantly helpful tool to address the issue by uniting the international community behind the effort to have political transition in Syria. There is an effort underway in a group called the Friends of the Syrian People. Those who are involved in that, which are a broad range, including us, a broad range of countries, are working together to coordinate their political and their economic and their assistance efforts for Syria. I think that has been helpful. And as I say, I think there are ways that we bilaterally and we with our friends can help address at least some of the very critical elements of humanitarian assistance. That we're doing a lot on the humanitarian front, and we are trying to work with others to ensure that when the day comes that Syria can move forward, those who support Syria's transition are prepared to provide the assistance that they will need to cement the gains that they are seeking through this very difficult process that they're going through.
And then turning back to just your broad diplomatic experience, you've served both in Western Europe as well as in the Middle East. I think some of our budding ambassadors here in the crowd want to know if you could just highlight some of the different experiences or approaches you might take when you're dealing with ambassadors, the diplomat community in Western Europe as opposed to in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, I've been very fortunate to spend, I've spent 12 years serving in Germany, And then I've now spent, I think, 13 years in the Middle East. So I've had that very interesting opportunity to get to have that in-depth experience in two very different areas of the world and countries that have different societies and different histories. In both cases, as a diplomat, and to you potential budding diplomats, I would encourage you to consider the diplomatic service as something that you might do. I think you would find, I have found, it's been a very rewarding experience. Our friends really appreciate our engagement. There is a tremendous reservoir of goodwill towards the American people and our country, and certainly great respect for our principles and sort of the freedoms that we enjoy. And so in that experience, having spent now more than two decades in foreign countries representing our country, is a very gratifying and a very rewarding one. In terms of the two kinds of cultures, they are rather different. As you know, in Germany, where I served, they're much more familiar with Americans from personal experience. Their own societies share a strong kind of a historical tradition with ours as Western countries. And so in that sense, it's more similar to the experience here. But in the Middle East, those of you who've been to the Middle East, I'm sure, are aware, they have a very well-deserved reputation for hospitality. And so I've been very, very pleased at just how warmly I and my family and my colleagues have been in those countries. So in both cases, it's really been a very positive experience. And as I say, I've been very, very fortunate to have had that and would encourage those of you who are looking for a way to engage on behalf of your country to consider such a career.
In light of the recent video that has been around the web, one of the members of the audience asked if there should be self-censorship or government censorship of websites such as YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, to help stop some more outrageous attacks on other people's on religion or more provocative examples.
Well, certainly, as you know, in our country, that is not something that we do. That is not the approach we take. It often leads to great unhappiness even among Americans when things are done that are very offensive to significant numbers of people in the name of free speech. We still typically defend free speech. The challenge in this internet age is that something done like that, which in the past might have never seen the light of day, certainly the people would not have the ability to bring it to the attention of large audiences. Unfortunately, now those people who wish to do that have that ability. And then potentially even on the other side, if you have those who wish to use those kinds of provocative actions on their own behalf overseas, you can see that happening as well. So certainly my position, and I know Americans in general still believe are absolutely supportive of the kinds of free expression that we enjoy in our country. So I would never think that we would want to have any censorship or something like that. But it does bring with it the challenge of education, the challenge of trying to convey that this freedom can be misused, is misused, and when it is misused, it should be seen for what it is, instead of taken at face value and allowing people to become provoked into violent acts or other things.
And along that line, what are the tools, the public diplomacy tools that the United States can use to help the governments that are in transition now?
Well, that's a very important issue in today's circumstances. Last week was a very good case in point, what we all saw, unfortunately, was this deliberate effort to provoke by this either person or persons here, then found those on the other side who were prepared to use that material to be provocative in their own right. And it had we and the governments in the region and responsible leaders of all types in the region reacting and responding to this provocation. So clearly, what we did and what we continued to do is make it very clear through our leaders and through our embassies and elsewhere that this particular film, in this particular instance, obviously we, the government, have nothing to do with. We find it abhorrent, and it is the work of someone whose views, obviously, we and very, very few people in the United States share. So we need to get that message out. The leaders in those countries need also to make sure that they're doing their best to educate the people as to where this is coming from and what's behind it, and then other leaders. And so we've been very pleased to see not only have political leaders, presidents and prime ministers, spoken out against the violence and against the reaction, but we've had from mosques, we've had from political parties, we've had from a variety of influential people in the region, comments to try to clarify, explain, and defuse the kinds of reactions that we're seeing. And it's important that we and others make that effort when something unfortunate like this takes place and misleads people into violent acts.
And we also have a series of questions about sort of outside influences in Syria and the impact that they're having. So, for example, Iran has become more visible recently with respect to Syria. And how does that change the United States approach, if at all, to Syria? Another person asks, why is Russia taking the position it is? And they don't understand why, since that's leading to more instability in Syria. And also, too, we're hearing more reports about possibly Islamist influences from outside of Syria coming into Syria. And didn't know if you could comment on those impacts.
Well, I think all of those are important elements of what I was describing before of the complexity of the situation and the importance for us and those others of goodwill towards Syria to remain engaged, to try to support those who are seeking what we think is the appropriate outcome and what the bulk of the Syrian people would seek as the appropriate outcome. Because you've alluded to a number of the factors at play. Iran has long had a relationship with Syria, and part of that seems to relate to the fact of the Shia-Sunni dynamic in the region. And then that dynamic now seems to be playing a role in the reaction of some of the Sunni states in the region. Russia has long had a security relationship with Syria. That seems to be playing a role in their approach to the region. And as you point out, certainly the extremists will leave no opportunity unused to try to exert their influence into any volatile situation that they can. And so there are a number of sort of elements and actors that are out there that make the situation as complicated as it is and really require that those of us who are seeking to help Syria move to a better place be very cautious in sort of identifying and then appropriately supporting those who really do share the kinds of goals that we want to see. So those are factors that we're constantly reassessing, engaging certainly with Russia as with China, seeking to convince them to change course, with Iran obviously telling them where we stand on their meddling or involvement there, and working with the other countries in the region to try to ensure that sectarian elements or sectarian factors really are not those factors at play, but rather that we are all moving towards, we're all trying to help Syria move towards a society which is tolerant, which is moderate, which respects the rights of all, including minorities. And that kind of society is something that all of us who are supporting Syria would like to see the people of Syria attain as soon as possible.
And along that line, are there any particular groups or organizations within Syria that the United States would like to see you know, be in a leadership role ultimately, assuming there is regime change? And what role, if any, do you see the United States playing once there is, or assuming there is, regime change?
Well, basically, our approach, and I alluded to this a bit, is to try to encourage the very disparate elements of the opposition to unify and to coordinate and to decide among themselves on behalf of the Syrian people how they want their sort of their new country sort of established and led, and how they want that process to unfold. So I can't say that that there's any specific group or person or element that we're seeking specifically to promote or support. What we're doing is trying to work with all of those in the opposition to get them to be as effective and as articulate and as clear as possible about what they are seeking to accomplish, who and how they are seeking to do that, and to get then those who support Syria behind that move. But no, I can't say that there's any specific group that we're looking at in particular.
Okay. And there's just several questions.
Right.
I know. That's what I'm trying to say. I don't know if you feel comfortable commenting on Iran. I know tomorrow night we're going to be having a full program just on
more expertise
on it. But if you could just comment on up to this point, sanctions haven't had that much of an impact, it seems, in Iran. What other actions are being taken that you can comment on to try to pressure?
Well, as I say, our approach really has been two-pronged. It's been the willingness for dialogue, and there's been you may be familiar with the acronym P5+1, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany have been engaging Iran on the nuclear issue, trying to seek a breakthrough to get them to change their approach. And at the same time, there have been a whole series of sanctions, both individual unilateral sanctions by the United States and global sanctions through the UN, as well as the EU has had its own sanctions and others. And so I do believe that the sanctions have had a strong enough impact on the Iranian people and therefore, on the Iranian leadership, to cause them to really begin to have to react and to have to reconsider. Now, there has not been any evidence to this point that they have changed course, but I do think the sanctions are an effective tool to cause them to understand the importance and, frankly, the potential difficulty that their country faces and is currently facing by being under sanctions and being so isolated from the international community. I know that we have, over time, stepped up the number and level of sanctions. I'm not aware specifically of current efforts to look at new sanctions. I'm not that much of an expert specifically on Iran. But certainly the process that we have followed continues, and that is to seek to bring more and more pressure to bear through sanctions to cause the Iranians to change course. I believe the sanctions are having some effect, and I'm certainly hopeful that the day will come soon when the tipping point is reached and the sanctions actually convince the Iranians of that they're doing themselves a disservice by pursuing their current policy in the nuclear area.
And there have been a number of countries in the Middle East and North Africa, including the Gulf, in which there hasn't been the full impact, one might say, of the Arab Spring. Have you seen an impact in countries such as Jordan, perhaps Morocco, Kuwait, Bahrain? Bahrain, obviously, there's been lots of violence, but in terms of changes that the governments are willing to initiate?
Well, I'm not an expert specifically on each of those countries, although I'm familiar more with Bahrain and the Gulf than North Africa. But I am aware that in Morocco and Jordan, there have been new initiatives to bring in, to give a greater voice to the people and to have the government be more responsive to the people. I just by chance happened to participate in an event last week with a Moroccan delegation and learned a little bit about a number of the initiatives that are being taken there in that direction. Likewise, in Jordan, in the Gulf, similarly, I think that the leaders in the Gulf are aware of and are seeking ways to be more responsive, to incorporate more opportunities for the people's voice to be heard, for the governments to be representative of the people and responsive to the people. Each country obviously has to take its own course. Where I was, as I had described earlier, in Oman, the leader, Sultan Qaboos, did implement a number of reforms which gave greater voice and greater responsiveness for the people. I think in the other countries in the region, different elements of the government are sort of working with each other. Some are more forward-leaning, some are less. But I think they've all understood the dynamic and, frankly, the demand on them to move their countries into a place where the people's voice does have more of an impact. So I think they're all moving in that direction, some faster than others, but I think they're all very aware of the need to pursue that course of action.
Thank you very much. That concludes our program for this evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Ambassador Richard Schmier for his excellent talk and discussion. I'd like to thank you, the audience, also for your excellent questions. Thank you, and have a good night.
Thank you.
And unfortunately, the ambassador has to catch a plane right after this, so unfortunately he won't be able to stick around and answer individual questions. My apologies.
Thank you very much. Oh, very nice.